such that they are not necessarily tied to male and female? Is there so much cultural baggage attached to these terms that they are unable to escape traditional gender stereotyping? Have such symbols become so tainted by heretofore accepted patriarchal definitions that they no longer are useful and must be discarded? Considering these and other equally compelling questions are our panelists, Mike Austin, Catherine Turley-Sahni, Barbara Bishop, and Joanna Brooks. Mike Austin is currently a PhD student in English at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He is the former president of the College Democrats and a former member of Voice. And a former member of Voice, a feminist student organization at BYU. He currently serves as a gospel doctrine teacher in his ward. While Mike's presentation is by no means without a theoretical base, I've asked him to go first because I thought it might be helpful to begin with the more concrete and move on to the more abstract and theoretical. Mike will approach the question of spiritual and gender roles with the following four assumptions. That the way we as Mormons perceive spirituality is conditioned, at least in part, by the way that the society we live in understands gender roles. That gender roles in a given society are conditioned by that society's infrastructure. That the infrastructural change from an agrarian to an industrial society in 19th century America precipitated a change in the way that Mormons viewed the spiritual roles of both men and women. That we are now experiencing a second infrastructural transformation that has significant implications for gender roles in our society at large and our religious community. Catherine Turley-Sahni holds an MA degree in English from BYU. She is married, has a daughter and a son, and teaches at Orange Coast Community College. She presently serves as the primary president in her ward. Catherine believes that the spiritual polarization of men and women prevents both genders from maximizing their spiritual power. Spiritual segregation is an unhealthy and limiting practice, whereas a feminine with a capital F, feminine signified spirituality, is spherical and encompassing in nature and is androgynous. Barbara Bishop received her PhD in English from UCLA. She is married, has two sons, and currently is the book review editor for the Mormon Women's Forum Quarterly. Barbara comes at the issue of gender and spirituality from a Jungian perspective. More specifically, she looks at the subjective experience of dreams, personal revelation, and intuition, and how they generate individual spirituality. Joanna Brooks is presently a master's student in English at UCLA. In response to the recent controversy over the lack of academic freedom at BYU, she, from what I understand, returned her BA degree to BYU. Joanna suggests that union is the key to exaltation. Union depends, among other things, on balanced interdependence of the masculine and the feminine, capital M, capital F, which are not the same thing as male and female. Joanna rejects assigned gender positionality based on woman as child producer and man as producer of structure and form, i.e. authority. Indeed, like many younger, under 30 feminists in the church, she feels no nostalgia for nor desire to conform to traditional patriarchal structures. Rather, she explores the possibility of women occupying a position free from formal requirement. Mike.
Like Joanna, I used to be comfortable separating the world into under 30 and over 30, but I'm not anymore. Since Marie Cornwell just came in the room and I'm going to be doing something that kind of looks like sociology, I feel that I have to say that it's not very good sociology, and it has absolutely no empirical data, and it's anecdotal and observational, and it just is because I'm not a sociologist. I'm an English major, and we take this as fiction. If it's not good sociology, take it as a short story. Okay. Those are all my disclaimers. Okay. I would like to begin with two quotations that together say a great deal about the way that our society has constructed both gender and spirituality in the 20th century. The first comes from Imamu Amare Baraka, a liberal black playwright and radical Muslim separatist, in his article, Black Women. And he says, "Those were the days, all right. A man was a man, and a woman was a woman, and each of them knew what that meant. Father was the head of the family in the real sense of the term. Mother respected him for it and received all the gratification she needed or wanted at home, doing her well-defined jobs. Man was strong, woman was feminine, and there was little loose talk about phony equality." The second observation comes from Helen B. Andelin, a conservative white author and complacent Mormon housewife, in her book Fascinating Womanhood, which is still in print after more than 30 years. And Sister Andelin says, "What is the role of man? It is to be the guide, protector, and provider for his wife and children. This role is not merely a result of custom or tradition, but is of divine origin. It was God who placed the man at the head of the family and commanded him to earn the bread. Women were given a different assignment, that of wife, mother, and homemaker. Marriage is a partnership, but it is not an equal partnership." Now, it would be difficult to imagine a pair of bedfellows stranger than Imamu Amare Baraka and Helen B. Andelin. The former, a well-known black nationalist, wrote Black Women as part of a call for revolution and separation. The latter, an obscure homemaker from Santa Barbara, California, three blocks from where I live, wrote Fascinating Womanhood as an etiquette manual for married women trying to keep their man. The two authors represent polar opposite positions on a number of important cultural binaries: black-white, radical-conservative, working class to leisure class, Eastern or Westerner, Muslim, Christian, male, female. Yet the only significant areas in which their subject matters intersect produces complete and unqualified agreement. The structure, argument, and logic of these two passages are completely interchangeable, and both rely on four basic assumptions about the spirituality of gender. One, that men and women are separated by barriers that transcend culture or socialization. Two, that a man's spirituality is defined by the professional sphere. Three, that a woman's spirituality is defined by the domestic sphere. And four, that this relationship is inherently unequal. These attitudes are not specifically Muslim or Mormon. They have been more or less universal over the past 100 years and continue to condition our society's perceptions today. I'm not here to evaluate or pass judgment upon them. I do not wish to propose, as some are inclined to do, that any family relationship they produce is inherently evil, sexist, and oppressive. Millions of men and women of all denominations have created happy, stable, fulfilling families around these principles, one of which I grew up in, and it's not in my nature to devalue or cast aspersions on the experiences of anybody who has found happiness or fulfillment in any relationship. What I do wish to suggest, however, is that the above propositions are not ahistorical absolutes, that they grow out of and are constrained by a specific set of historical and economic circumstances. The homework dichotomy, as we know it, is a product of the Industrial Revolution. In the early part of the 19th century, when most people lived and worked in the same space, notions of family, gender, and spiritual roles were decidedly different than they are today. For example, in the 19th century, it was fairly common for the church to call a married man on a mission for 2 or 3 years, leaving his wife to manage the family farm or business and provide for the children. Women, in other words, receive the spiritual duty of becoming the provider. Such a thing would never even be considered by the missionary department today, when a woman's spirituality is defined by her success in the home. But in a society that recognized no meaningful distinction between home and work, the statement, "a woman's place is in the home," did not make the same sort of sense that it makes to us today. As the infrastructure of society shifted from an agrarian to an industrial economic base, the physical distinction between the domestic and the professional spheres emerged as a rigid dividing line in our culture. Men took care of the job, women took care of the children, and that was that. Sometimes the system didn't work, but much of the time it did. And because it seemed like the best thing going, we began to construct definitions of spirituality around this dichotomy. Men were considered spiritually successful if they were good providers and wage earners, and women were considered spiritual if they were capable wives, mothers, and homemakers. People who didn't quite fit the model, because they weren't married, because they didn't have children, or heaven forbid, because they weren't married and did have children, were not considered spiritually whole until they got with the program. I realize how optimistic it is for me to use the past tense here, but bear with me, because I think the past tense at least ought to apply. As I said before, I do not intend to criticize either the social or the spiritual aspects of this system. It had a lot of problems, but it worked. It put chickens in most everybody's pot and cars in most everybody's garage, and it provided millions of people with meaningful guidelines for constructing their spiritual, religious, and ethical selves. However, most people will agree that for the last 30 years or so, the system hasn't been working very well. Various commentators have placed the blame for the breakdown of family values on the failure of some large section of our culture to observe their prescribed spiritual duties. Society is going to hell, we say, because women are working outside of the home, because men aren't willing to support their families, because adults are watching adult movies, because kids are watching Beavis and Butthead, or simply because we are part of the most wicked generation of human beings ever to inhabit planet Earth. Bunk. Family values, in my opinion, are breaking down because the infrastructural realities that they were created to support have shifted underneath our feet and caught us by surprise. We are no longer living in an industrial age or an economy in which the primary commodities are goods and services. We are rapidly becoming an information age or an economy in which the primary medium of exchange is information, and the most important jobs are becoming those which facilitate the creation, storage, retrieval, organization, and application of knowledge. Social implications of this change are immense, and I would like to list and briefly comment on two of many well-documented trends that, in my opinion, have been quietly shaping our lives for the past 30 years and will continue to do so well into the future. And this is where my bad sociology comes in. First of all, one-income families are becoming increasingly rare. Most women, Mormon or otherwise, will never have the choice of whether or not to enter the workplace at some time in their lives. This is not a matter of ski boats and late model cars. Our entire economy is constructing itself around a two-income model, and wages and prices will continue to reflect this assumption far into the future. But two, opportunities for both men and women to work inside of the home are becoming increasingly frequent. Knowledge is a commodity that can be created anywhere, and with word processors, faxes, modems, email, voicemail, cellular phones, and all of the coming features of the information superhighway, which is, by the way, how I found out about this symposium on the information superhighway. But with all of these innovations, work will no longer necessarily be the antithesis of home. Taken together, these two phenomena suggest the Industrial Revolution distinction between home and work, a dichotomy that has conditioned our society's assumptions about gender for more than 100 years, is collapsing from both ends. We can no longer think in terms of a female domestic sphere and a male professional sphere, since women currently make up as large a percentage of the workforce as men do. Nor can we look at home and work as opposite ends of a single dichotomy, since both men and women are conducting more and more of their business activities from their own homes. All of this means that, as both a church and a culture, Mormons will have to rethink the way that we define spirituality within the family unit. When we no longer have access to the home-work dichotomy, as we presently know it, then we can no longer separate male and female roles into the traditional provider and homemaker roles. And I want to emphasize, this does not mean that either providing or homemaking will, should, or ought to become less important to the success of the family unit. Nor does it mean that providing for a family and caring for children should no longer be considered part of one's spiritual duties. As a Mormon, I fundamentally believe that families are forever, that raising good children is the most important thing that we can accomplish in this world, and that no other success can compensate for failure in the home. However, the social conditions of our time make it increasingly difficult to parcel domestic duties in gender-specific packages, nor do I believe that such segregation is necessary or desirable. I do not believe that the statement, a woman's place is in the home, is an eternal principle. However, I do believe that it is based on one, that a parent's place is with his or her children. As an official body, the Church has recently made important strides towards recognizing the implications that I speak of. As a cultural body, Mormons still have a long way to go. To our own peril, we are still clinging to definitions of spirituality that reflect a world that we no longer inhabit. In such a world, a woman is certainly allowed to work outside of the home if she has to, as long as she has a low-paying, low-prestige job and hates every minute of it. Similarly, if a man in this world is welcome to play with his children for a few minutes after work or take them fishing on Saturdays, but if he works only a part-time job or spends an inordinate amount of time at home or allows his wife to get a job, even though he is completely capable of working longer hours, we question his commitment to the gospel. And this simply won't do. In the future, families will find that domestic and professional duties can be divided up along a number of non-traditional lines. What we must do as a church, I believe, is make sure that every family can make these decisions without having their individual spiritualities called into question. This means that we have to define spirituality for both men and women in a way that emphasizes options. Options for men and women to pursue completely traditional roles, if that's what they choose to do. Options that allow women to be spiritual in the workplace. Options that allow men to be spiritual in the kitchen. And options that allow for more church participation on the part of singles, single-parent families, and anybody else who doesn't fit nicely into the provider-homemaker dichotomy. Such a reconception of spiritual gender roles will be an integral part of our ability to minister to our children's generation and extend to them the assurances that Paul gave the Ephesians. Now, therefore, ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God. Thank you.
Since Mike made apologies, I guess that, Mike, I'm going to have to apologize if I have any sentence structure problems here. Because Mike is usually quick to correct me here, right?
Only when we're arguing.
Right. Freedom from the codependency of opposition is a necessary component in my personal revisioning of the definition of gender-neutral spirituality. I believe that the binary construct of roles is an obstacle which we are distracted by. This polarization of men and women prevents us both from maximizing our spiritual power in an interconnected manner. Power for men is equated with priesthood, and power for women is equated with motherhood, and the long-standing traditional answer for separate but equal. However, separate but equal has failed in racial, handicapped, and gender segregation. Expecting spiritual segregation to be healthy, productive, and fulfilling is a setup for failure and dissension. Virginia Woolf states in A Room of One's Own, "In each of us, two powers preside, one male, one female, and in the man's brain, the man predominates over the woman, and in the woman's brain, the woman predominates over the man. The normal and comfortable state of being is that when the two live in harmony together, spiritually cooperating. If one is a man, still the woman part of the brain must have effect, and woman also must have intercourse with the man in her. It is when this fusion takes place that a mind is fully fertilized and uses all its faculties. The androgynous mind is resonant and porous, that it transmits emotion without impediment, that it is naturally creative, incandescent, and undivided." Wolf still holds with some binary traits between men and women, but encourages a cooperation between the two different selves. The literary critic Elaine Showalter's theory of feminine liberation serves as a bridge in my concept of a spiritual self in the gospel. Some contemporary French feminists and modernists have gone a step beyond Wolf and expanded on Showalter's theories in their endorsement of and valuation of a feminine mind. Theirs is a study of linguistic processes rather than biological differentiation. Destruction of the linguistic binary obstacles allows for an unhindered androgynous semiotic process in which an intellectual and creative spirituality is born. A feminine signified mind, which can be biologically male or female, is spherical, bisexual, and androgynous, and multifunctional as opposed to a hierarchical, linear, and power-based. In order to survive in a church where role defining and hierarchy is implicit in its daily functioning, I must place it in the context of its culture, and I must have a personal revision of a feminine spirituality. In the text, Women's Voices, we can get a glimmer of what early Mormon women's spheres of activity included. The writings of Latter-day Saint women indicate that the women lived much of their lives in a subculture separate from men. It was a culture whose chief occupations were nurturing and housekeeping, and whose primary rituals centered around women's relationships with other women, children, and men. Nurturing was often extended beyond home into school teaching, nursing, and midwifery, and there was also a ready market outside the home for such homemaking skills as weaving, sewing, tailoring, cooking, and cleaning. The visiting that consistently strengthened bonds among women had its public counterpart in the gathering of women, relief societies, mutual improvement associations, and at the end of the century, women's clubs. These female occupations and rituals form the basis of a cultural history long untold. as women in the early church had increased awareness of the 19th century women's movement, they energetically expanded their spheres with increased education and entrepreneurial adventures in unusual fields. The LA Times recently had a lead article discussing the feminization of California's economy. Women continue to excel in non-traditional businesses and as creative voices in traditionally male roles. Women police officers have been overwhelmingly successful in Los Angeles in moderating tense domestic and criminal situations as well. The common thread, which seems to appear in all these situations, domestic to professional, is relationship-based. Interrelating and connecting in a spherical model rather than a hierarchical model bodes cooperation and equal empowerment of all contributors. Lighthearted or soul-searching, sharing among women was serious and is serious business. It is one means whereby we reaffirm the reality and significance of our female culture. Inspiring spiritual gatherings characterize many female saints' experiences. Healing the sick, speaking in tongues, and prophesying were occasions of joy and rejoicing. Mary Fielding Smith wrote in a letter to her sister, "Some of the sisters, while engaged in conversing in tongues, their countenances beaming with joy, clasped each other's hands and kissed in the most affectionate manner." The study of women in my history and the early women in the church has been aided by the feminist theory posited by literary critic Elaine Showalter in a text, A Literature of Their Own. The theory has three stages which have been helpful in my examination of the women past and the contemporary women in the gospel. First, there is a prolonged phase of imitation of the prevailing modes of the dominant tradition, an internalization of its standards of art and its views on social roles. Second, there is a phase of protest against these standards and values and advocacy of minority rights and values, including a demand for autonomy. Finally, there's a phase of self-discovery, a turning inward freed from some of the dependency of opposition in a search for identity. I believe these phases to be cyclical, meaning that after the third phase is completed, that full liberation is not guaranteed permanence, but rather permanence would be contrary to a spherical model of movement. I also believe that these phases can concurrently be played out, impacting others and serving as catalysts for phase shifts. The level of spirituality of many 19th century women in the gospel is characteristic of Showalter's third phase of development. These women turned inward and utilized their innate spiritual gifts in an empowering, connected, communal manner. But organized hierarchical power structures are threatened by such powerful sharing. Thus, auxiliarizing of the Relief Society and the withdrawing of approval of shared spirituality initiated a shift back to the first phase. The controlled manipulation of faith returned the spiritual power to the patriarchy. So as a result, women were forced to imitate and internalize their desires for increased spirituality into the constraints of their roles. The second phase, identified as protest and advocacy, is clearly in progress as we speak and has appeared sporadically in the past. This is, however, a critical stage. It's the stage where silencing is most frequently achieved, where cultural and administrative power is flexed, where resignation of exhausted participants is achieved. In order to move on to the third phase of self-discovery, we must either give up the battle in exchange for peace, or we must be capable of re-signifying the battle as a means of survival and spiritual empowerment. Contemporary French feminists have given me some necessary tools of survival in a hierarchically dependent church. Helene Sissou warns women of falling into the trap of seeking patriarchal constructed power. In so doing, women are falling into Showalter's first phase of imitation. They are attempting to be men, and they are condoning their constructs. In the patriarchal binary thought process, it is a general battlefield where the struggle for signifying supremacy is forever reenacted. In order for one term or one gender to acquire meaning, the other term or gender must be destroyed or devalued. Thus, women are forever in the passive roles of binary opposites. Sissou advocates a realm where binary structures do not connote power, where a free play of signifiers promotes meaning through connectedness rather than superiority. Sissou also espouses a bisexual writing that revels in open-ended textuality. Thus, we have a spherical model rather than a model with a beginning and an end. Another French feminist, Luce Irigaray, claims that historically the only time women have spoken outside the realm of patriarchal language is in the context of mysticism. the mystical experience is precisely an experience of the loss of subjecthood, of the disappearance of the subject-object opposition. It would seem to hold a particular appeal for women whose very subjectivity is anyway being denied and repressed by patriarchal discourse. Though not all mystics were women, mysticism nevertheless seems to have formed the one area of high spiritual endeavor under patriarchy where women could and did excel more frequently than men. Touched by the flames of the divine, the mystic soul is transformed into a fluid stream dissolving all difference. This orgasmic experience eludes the specular rationality of patriarchal logic. Mysticism, or the belief in direct or intuitive attainment of communion with God or of spiritual beliefs, has resurfaced throughout women's history. It is reminiscent of Anne Hutchinson's experience in an early patriarchal Puritan community. She preached a doctrine of salvation realized through the intuition of God's indwelling grace. Her ideas eliminated the need for institutionalized hierarchy as an intermediary from the individual to God. Her mystical beliefs and spiritual power were considered a threat to the authority of Massachusetts clergy, and banishment was ordered. The experiences of early women saints in a Victorian-based community also parallels the continuing penalties for practicing mysticism. Women's direct access to the spiritual powers of healing, blessing, speaking in tongues, and prophesying were considered a threat to the binary construct of men as spiritual guides to women. Therefore, they were removed from women's grasp. The trend continues in modern times. Rather than allow women the opportunity to participate in blessing circles, ambiguous rules are changed so that spiritual elimination of women is explicit, and communal sharing and recording of spiritual abuse is feared and being excised from our communities. Additionally, Irigaray claims that women also escape patriarchal structures when they gather together and they participate in woman speak. Woman speak is a woman's language which emerges spontaneously when women speak together. Thus, we see the appeal of women's groups such as Mormon Women's Forum. But any women's group must be separate from patriarchal authority in order to function apart from male signifiers. Thus, we see why contemporary relief society is unable to facilitate a free play of signifiers, while early relief society, pre-auxiliarization, was conducive to mystical freedom and spiritual dynamicism. Julia Kristeva, another French philosopher, argues very specifically that linguistics must be studied from a semiotic perspective in order to understand and change the pre-Oedipal development of choices of language. The initial semiotic period of language development comes in the pre-Oedipal stage when a child perceives no separation between itself and the world. Binary definitions are not yet a conditioned response. As a child moves from the semiotic stage to the symbolic stage, there is an acceptance of the phallus as representation of the law. In order to re-access the semiotic, all phallic language structures must be questioned and not regarded as absolute truth. Our current spiritual language does not allow for a free play of these signifiers. Thus, women continually play a passive role to the binary superiority of priesthood language. In order to have a spiritually fulfilling experience in a male-constructed church, we must rely on ourselves to re-signify our personal experience in a language and context where we can have a dynamic spiritual encounter with God. Can we re-signify our experience and still fully participate in the gospel? I believe that re-signifying spirituality for women and men concerned with inequities is an option for survival within the current structure. I would also like to emphasize that both men and women can participate in this resignification. The term feminine in this context connotes a process, not a biological identity. Revisioning and resignifying the patriarchal constructs that we trust to provide us with a spiritual experience and valuing our own intuition will free us from our codependency on binary answers to a spherical gospel model, so that ultimately we can engage in a spiritual experience that is, as Wolfe suggested, possible. Resonant and porous, transmitting emotion without impediment, that is naturally creative, incandescent, and undivided. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to talk about the mystical, too, so ours will overlap just a little bit, maybe more than a little bit. You may recall the story of Jacob who wrestled with the angel and came away with a dislocated hip. In those fortunate days, writes Carl Jung, Jacob's story was believed without question. A contemporary Jacob telling such a tale would be treated to meaningful smiles. My psychology professor this trimester is one such individual. He announced on the first day, "I am a scientist. I look at things objectively. I examine the data to arrive at a true picture of human nature." This professor, you won't be surprised to learn that he has saved his most condemnatory, nasty remarks for Carl Jung. Jung was a nutcase, Professor Meadows told us. He believed he had visions. He heard voices. He said some dreams were prophetic. He made a religion out of his psychology. He was so psychotic he lost his grip on reality. He was schizophrenic. It is true that Jung claimed God was the most certain and immediate of experiences. What Jung called spiritual, my psychology professor labels pathologic. In the original version of the children's song, "I Am a Child of God," the last line of the chorus reads, teach me all that I must know to live with him someday. The words were changed sometime in the 1970s to read, teach me all that I must do. It strikes me that doing focuses on external activities that can be seen, measured, and assessed. It is a manner we are well acquainted with in our church. Knowing, on the other hand, hints at what I would call a being mode, B-E-I-N-G, and that, for me, is feminine and less well known. A being mode is receptive, not passive. In a being mode, the individual turns inward for answers rather than to external authorities. In seeking to describe feminine spirituality, I want to make clear that I do not ascribe this to women only. Men as well as women have the capacity to look inside and develop an internalized, wholly subjective spiritual life, which leads to wholeness and includes direct experiences with God. I access a being mode primarily through dream recall and interpretation. A being mode is the goal of meditation, if meditation can be said to have a goal, Tai Chi and yoga, which teaches people to listen to their bodies and listen through their bodies to the divine. It develops openness, independence, self-trust, and love. It is the primary attitude in receiving answers to prayers. For example, just before Christmas 3 years ago, I was trying to decide whether or not we should go to Utah for Christmas. In the middle of the night, I sat rocking my then 2-year-old son, who was sick and feverish. Our car was not working very well, and I wondered if it would even make it. In addition, big snowstorms throughout Utah made road conditions hazardous. My brother, in fact, had called me that day from Utah and encouraged me not to come. I was apprehensive for a number of reasons, but my mother and father very much wanted us to be there for a family gathering. As I sat rocking Andrew, pondering these things in my heart, a single line from a Christmas song popped into my head: to face unafraid the plans that we've made. We drove to and from Utah without incident. Who popped that phrase into my head? How did it happen? I have no idea. I cannot explain the mystical, but I cannot deny its presence in my life either. Answers appear in such a subtle, quiet fashion, I often question whether or not I've had an experience or just a train of thought. Meditation, in fact, often begins as a jumble of chaotic thoughts about what to fix for dinner and what I'm going to do next, but ideally moves into body awareness, self-awareness, and spiritual reality. A being mode expands consciousness and encourages the development of the imagination in virtually all creative endeavors. It is no accident that poets speak of their muse as being female. Everyone, I believe, has an inner muse or guide who can provide wisdom and direct our lives for good. Terry Tempest Williams' book, Refuge, strikes me as an elegant rendering of spirituality generated from Mother Earth energy. This is true in spite of her subtitle, An Unnatural History of Time and Place. The natural, it seems to me, comes to assume at least as prominent of a place in that book as the unnatural events of her mother's cancer and the 1983 flooding of Salt Lake City, which she reports. It is a disturbing yet hopeful book for that reason. In a being mode, we come to understand some events, not necessarily all, in our waking lives as symbolic and purposeful rather than random and meaningless. Often events involving great suffering are designed or seem to guide us to new levels of understanding, self-knowledge, and compassion. Sometimes dreams will tell us a meaning we are too obtuse or stubborn to comprehend. When my youngest son was 2 months old, I carried him out of church in his baby seat. I opened our minivan, set him on the edge next to the seat, and held him there with my knee as I put my older son in his car seat. I was pressing hard enough with my knee against the carrier that it flipped out of the car and Justin landed on his head. He's fine. That night, I replayed the entire scene in my dream. At the end of the dream, I heard a voice say, "When you press too hard, it hurts their heads." I have thought about that event and that dream many, many times as I have tried to become more conscious of my own control issues and my communication patterns with my children. I call such dreams 2x4 therapy. It was not just my son who got hit over the head. Feminine spirituality entails a groundedness in the body. It accepts and enjoys sexuality and sensuality. It includes laughter, playfulness, and joy. In the unfolding of feminine spirituality, a person learns to listen to and trust body messages. In its positive form, feminine energy is healing, life-affirming, and flowing. It affirms the body, whatever its size, its supposed flaws, and distinct features. The process of moving towards a body center may involve caring for a garden, doing yoga, having a dog or a cat, taking a daily walk, hiking, or other forms of outdoor exercise. Some of my most spiritual experiences have occurred while climbing Timpanogos with siblings and friends. Hiking that mountain centers me in my body as I partake of the sensory feast around me. Sometimes a great deal of spiritual growth comes from illnesses that refocus our attention on the body. When we concentrate on matter or Mother Earth, we can often discover some important symbolism regarding our diseased body and learn some important things about our life. Feminine spirituality asserts the importance of timing. Different times of the day, different times of the month, and different times in our lives. Sometimes when we aren't paying quite enough attention to our dissatisfaction with an unfulfilling job or being stuck in other ways, we'll have a nightmare in which someone frightening chases us. Night demons get our attention. They wake us up to the notion that we have insides and almost force us to listen. Jung writes, "Where danger is, there is salvation also." An increase of shadow energy in our dreams can propel us forward towards spiritual transformation when it is acknowledged and redeemed. In a being mode, we trust the instinctual rather than the rational and reasonable. A woman in my ward told me that when she was 21, she had several dreams of car accidents. I dreamed that my friend picked me up to go out for a drive. We got into an accident with a truck as we were about to turn left. The truck hit the passenger side where I was sitting and smashed the door far inside the car. In my dream, I die and my friend gets away with bruises. I had that dream over and over, Damaris told me. The dream was more vivid than most dreams. I saw the truck so clearly it was a vision, and it was driving me crazy. I even told my friend about the dream. I told her to be more careful when she drove. One rainy Thursday, as Damaris was getting ready to go out with her friend, the dream suddenly flashed before her. She stopped short and announced that she did not want to go. The following Sunday, she learned that her friend had been in an accident on that very day. The accident occurred exactly the way Damaris' dream had predicted, and Damaris knew the color of the truck that hit her friend's car. Damaris cannot prove that heeding these warning dreams saved her life. Nor is this story and similar stories the stuff which makes up traditional doctrine and theology. In his Trial of Human Courage, writes Jung, God refuses to abide by traditions. It takes courage to cultivate and trust intuitive understanding that makes no sense in a world which has sold its soul for a mass of disconnected facts. It is risky. The mysterious realm of dreams, visions, and revelations pose more questions than answers. Why was Damaris saved, for example, but not others? It seems almost as if destiny poses questions to us which we have the opportunity to answer if we are listening. If we are listening. I have a sense that we haven't been trained how to listen. I know I wasn't. When Jung visited the Pueblo Indian chief in New Mexico, the chief said, "I don't understand white men. They are always seeking something. They are always uneasy and restless. We think they are mad. They think with their heads." Jung said, "Why, of course. How do you think?" The chief pointed to his heart. The following dream describes the situation in our culture, and I need to give you some background. The woman Emma, and I've changed the name, she taught in our ward for a number of years, taught Sunday school, and she's very rational, very doctrine-oriented, and very male-identified. And it's not my dream, it's someone else's. I was sitting at the park at a table to eat. I was sitting with Emma. Emma said, did you feel the spirit? Yes, I did, I replied. Suddenly, something told me to turn around. I did, and I saw the Savior standing by me face to face, looking into my eyes, smiling. His eyes, I always see his eyes. I asked Emma, are you seeing the Savior? She said, no, I don't see anything. I replied, he's right here. I turned around and he was still there. I came close to him, sitting on the bench, and faced him, and I caressed him with my hands. I woke up feeling like I was in the clouds. I was strengthened. A few weeks ago, I casually asked Rosa, whose dream I just recounted, if she had ever dreamed about Jesus. Oh, yes, she replied, all the time. I was stunned because I, for one, have never dreamed about Jesus, though he is supposed to be the figure around whom I center my life. I asked her if she would remind recounting those dreams to me. She said, which ones? There are so many. Which ones would you like to hear? And then she told me stories about dreams that she had had about Jesus for the next 2 hours. Increasingly, feminine spirituality includes experiences with the divine feminine. In The Feminine Face of God, Sherry Anderson recounts a powerful dream about the goddess that led her to an exploration of feminine spirituality and eventually to the writing of her book. There are numerous other accounts now in print of people's experiences with the goddess. The development over the centuries of a divine triad, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, is incomplete. It needs the feminine principle to complete the divine quaternary or mandala. Sometimes the divine feminine appears in dreams as Sophia, the Black Madonna, a medicine woman, or another wise healer. We have the opportunity to meet the goddess and integrate goddess energy into our psyches if we are listening and if we pay heed to our dreams. Jung notes that men and women are indispensable for the completion of creation. The revelation of the goddess, I believe, requires our aid to bring her to consciousness. Carolyn Pearson's play, Mother Wove the Morning, offers us one such revelation, and I hope more will come. Spirituality for me includes both masculine and feminine modes. I believe that both are necessary. If creativity is feminine, the drive that gets me into my study and compels me to put fingers to the keyboard and write is a masculine energy. Without masculine energy, all my ideas would remain inside. The masculine sends it out into the world. The process towards consciousness and wholeness balances masculine and feminine energies. Our Western culture has leaned towards the masculine side so far that the masculine has been distorted into patriarchy and the feminine has been largely ignored and forgotten. That is changing. This change has unexpected rewards. When we detach ourselves from traditional ideology, expectations, and even accepted truths, we open ourselves up to the mystery of the divine. That, in turn, deepens our understanding and reconnects us with previously denied aspects of ourself. We are given the opportunity to relate to others at a more profound level. Through this transformation process, we eventually come to see a pattern or river running through our lives. This eternal water nourishes and sustains us in times of darkness. We come to an appreciation for the great mystery of God, of being, and of life.
Well, I suppose I start my presentation where all of my other panelists have started theirs as well, by attempting to define terms, so the feminine and spirituality. And we all know we could spend several hours working on defining terms. Books and lives and careers are devoted to such metaphysics, and I think it's one of the most tedious exercises ever invented. It's like a big metaphysical hamster treadmill that the great philosophical forefathers told us we had to run before we could really get to the real business, which is saving each other's lives. So I'll be quick about the business, then get down to the good stuff. What is the feminine? Does being a female make you feminine? And what does being female mean? Does it mean having a vagina? Does it mean wearing pink and playing with Barbies? Are vaginas inherently feminine? Are Barbies? Mormon epistemology would tell us that whatever we know by thinking about it and then consulting with the Spirit. Do any of us have any kind of perspective on our vast range of personal experience that would allow us to examine strand by strand, thread by thread, our natures and say, that's feminine, that's masculine? Do we have the perspective to create a taxonomy of experience? I don't think so. As with deep couch work, deep Freudian type therapy, I think most of this kind of deconstruction of being is just really confusing in the end. Most of us have no option but to take our person as we know it and to do the best we can, just to get through the day and try to live right. So what is the feminine? Well, I suggest the feminine is a positionality. It's a position sometimes assigned and sometimes assumed and sometimes defined by old white men for us and sometimes taken back and defined by ourselves. Can men occupy a feminine position? Sure. Can women? Sure. Can men occupy a masculine position? Sure. Can women? Sure. All of us are masculine and feminine and a little of both, and all of us are a little crazy, and most of what we are has little to do with what our external marks of sex are. Godhood is defined by a complete and balanced interdependence of masculine and feminine roles and powers and natures. Think about it. Heavenly Father would not be Heavenly Father without Heavenly Mother, and vice versa. There are no gender roles in the celestial kingdom. I believe that we assign gender roles back to the entity we believe is God. That's our way of understanding what's going on up there. Godhead, by definition, requires a oneness, a complete intermingling and interdependency of power and person. I seriously doubt that Heavenly Mother and Heavenly Father are the perfect stay-at-home, milk-churning mother and the perfect pinstripe-wearing authoritative father. And thank heavens, I won't go to heaven if I know I have to make glass grapes there. We know that we are as they once were, and that as they are, we may become. Certainly none of us are perfectly masculine or feminine. We're all a little of both. And when we strive for union with our eternal companion, we learn to support and sustain each other and to comply with some universal physical laws which demand a balance and forces. So the rigor with which the external signifier of sex, what parts you got, is correlated to a certain set of behaviors. This varies over time. I mean, even within our own Mormon culture, thanks to the life-saving work of historians like Michael Quinn and Maxine Hanks, we can see how having a female body is signifying very different things over the history of this church. For example, the days of Joseph Smith, having a female body meant that you could lay on hands and hold keys and heal. And in the days of Spencer Kimball, the female body meant you couldn't even give the prayer over the pulpit and sacrament meeting. What female means and what feminine means depends on who's making the definition. Okay? So now I get to say what I really want to say. There is no feminine spirituality, and there's no masculine spirituality. There's just spirituality. There's Joanna's spirituality, and Mike's spirituality, and Mom's spirituality, and Boyd K. Packer has one somewhere, and Sonia Johnson's spirituality as well. And occasionally, because this is a terrestrial, this is a fallen world, and certain laws of physics prevent us here from the celestial speed of light type union that exaltation promises us, we have to symbolically and ritually approximate that higher state in the fallen language we have. Hence, in our church rituals, people are as much symbolic as anything else. Let us remember again and again that people choose to stand in for these parts for the good of the ritual. Certainly those brethren who are asked and agreed to play Lucifer in the temples around the world were not expected to be Lucifer every day, and they probably weren't treated too badly at ward parties because of it. Their highly defined role was part of a highly symbolic ritual that had its proper context within a certain setting. Men in sacrament meetings stand in to pass a sacrament as part of a highly ritualized, highly symbolic context. Women in the temple stand in as a symbol of the feminine principle of power. And why is the woman still veiled in the temple? Because certain people aren't paying attention yet. Doesn't the Book of Mormon show us that with great enough faith, we cannot be kept from without the veil? Certainly the veil signifies more about our collective spiritual maturity than it does about the person who's wearing it. The few rituals that our Mormon religion has are certainly highly refined and highly specialized. Day-to-day life is another symbolic context entirely. And just as we individuals choose to play the symbolic parts rituals ask us to, we can also choose how to play those parts during the hours and days and weeks that make up the vast majority of our lives. I mean, how much of our lives as Mormons is lived within the temple? Not much, relatively. Most of our Mormonism functions on the block, at the dinner table, at school, in front of the television, hosing down the driveway. Unfortunately, as many times as we are told as many times as we are told that what goes on in the temple is specific to that holy context, we are stupid, and we extrapolate it to everyday things like who has to make dinner, or change the diapers, or who says the opening prayer. And it really makes things quite difficult and pretty ridiculous. You first. No, you first. No, you first. I think the handbook says that the third cousin of the head man in charge is responsible for passing out the sacrament meeting programs. I believe that the washing of casserole dishes after the ward dinner is appropriately accomplished by those who, yea, verily, are the producers of all body and flesh, the women. So meanwhile, we're so busy deciding who is proper for what role and who does what based on our limited understanding of what gender signifies, that the work just doesn't get done. It just baffles the mind how much time gets wasted. There is so much work to be done, so much good news to spread. And we spend so much time in rhetoric and self-defensive political maneuvering, which really has nothing to do with saving lives. Another highly symbolic ritual context, which has been grossly overinterpreted to signify everything for the rest of our lives, in a dangerous case of biological determinism, is the physical process of parenthood. Long-standing cultural assumptions, which Sigmund Freud actually vocalized, tell us that all production results from desire, which results from lack. Thus, woman makes babies because she wants power, right? And to protect himself, the man's got to make a lot of structures, a lot of buildings, make up a lot of rules to keep that, quote-unquote, black widow spider, as Hartman Rector called her, away. He has to protect himself. Well, honestly, think about it. Childbearing had very little to do with desire until just a few years ago, when birth control became available. I mean, more often it was just coincidence, good or bad, but magical nonetheless. We know that God assigned Eve to be the childbearer and Adam to be the ground tiller after the fall, and that the roles are, again, fallen, terrestrial approximations of a higher order. We are eternal beings learning to master terrestrial conditions so that we can move on to celestial glories. This, all this, is temporary. All this overemphasis and assumptions and assignment made based on gender are completely extraneous to, and most often quite deleterious to, our development as celestial persons. The mothers in Israel are just people who had babies who are trying to work out their salvation. And the leaders of the church are not our fathers. They're brethren. Brethren who, like us, are just people trying to work out their salvation. Now, as a young Mormon feminist who has been very privileged to learn from many of my older feminist sisters, I've noticed a very interesting difference between the younger generation and the older, and I won't call it 30, because I know that's a no-no. And I don't believe in that 20-something stuff anyway. 40, anyone, 40. A lot of older Mormon feminists seem to feel a nostalgia for the time when their church fathers were friendly to them. And I seem to feel some need to be reclaimed by the church fathers to be heirs to some primogeniture-type handed-down structure. They want someone over the pulpit to tell them they're okay. They want to be invited to meetings. Truly, this has colored the nature of Mormon feminist activism, which I do not criticize. I support all of the efforts. Please understand this, but I'm just interested in the context which they came from. White roses, ribbons, conferences, our efforts seem uniformly directed at the church office building. Them up there signifying what we should be, and us on the street signifying back. Listen to us, we're important too, we say to them. It seems so strange that most of our feminist activism is aimed at convincing old set-in-their-ways Utah white men rather than at our sisters, women around the world with real needs. For a worldwide church, why is so much of our feminist focus on one square block in Salt Lake City? Younger feminists really, the ones I talked to at least, don't feel that much nostalgia. I could care less about meetings and being recognized. Meetings have no relationship to my spirituality. I have no nostalgia for a gentler time. I was baptized in the year of ERA, exactly 6 weeks before Sonia Johnson was excommunicated. Did I know who Sonia Johnson was when I got baptized? Yes, I did. At 8 years old, I knew who Sonia Johnson was. I remember going to a conference where Spencer Kimball spoke in the Rose Bowl and seeing the plane fly around with the banner. I remember. And did I know about the blacks in the priesthood? Yes, I did. I have always seen the church as an organization in flux. The authorities as my brethren and not as my fathers. I can argue with my brothers and still love them. Struggle has always been a part of it. I have never been a part of any feel-good empire in which if you play that role and I play this role, we'll all get along fine. Just don't ask questions. It has been a struggle every day of it, an absolute struggle for which I'm deeply grateful and which has brought me to my knees before my Heavenly Mother and Heavenly Father. And who has saved my life in this struggle time and time again? My sisters, and a few brothers, too. Dear friends, people who I have sustained relationships with. Conference comes and goes, and the great meetings go on behind the great closed doors, and I am never a part of it, and I really don't care. Boyd K. Packer speaks twice a year, and I speak to my sister on the phone every other day. Who has a greater impact on my spirituality? Where is the real work done? Not in meetings, not in one square block in Salt Lake on two holy Sundays a year. It is every day. It is everywhere. Do you see the power in this? We have no formal requirements. No silly twice weekly is everyone in line correlation meetings and big bulky folders. All that baggage. All we need is the spirit and conviction of our own authority as women in our own spiritual development, in the spiritual development of those who we have personal relationships with. Lateral networks, far branching, infinite networks of brothers and sisters. Have you heard of the Guerrilla Girls in the New York City arts community who by dark of night plastered the town with pro-woman posters? I have an idea. While the men are at their silly meetings, let's be spiritual guerrilla girls. How about we go visit the sick and clean up the environment and read good books and minister to each other and laugh and sing and bear testimony while they are bored as heck? Who needs top-down hierarchy? It is completely irrelevant to 99% of the work to be done here. But seriously, in order to do this, we need to convert ourselves first. That's the trick. Because in this terrestrial state, this epic, God told man to do the naming. But let's not forget the primacy of our bond with God, our mother, our father. And Adam's ability to name depends upon our acceptance of that name. If we, in consultation with God, decide the name doesn't work, let us consult with our brothers about it. And if they keep on calling us that name, let us cease to answer and keep about our work. Let us women recognize our own spiritual authority. We are certainly authorities in our own spiritual development. We can choose how and when to enter into the symbolic contract of ritual, and how and what women will mean in our homes, our Sunday school classes, and our personal relationships. I have seen too much, and it makes me cry, of these wise old women in Relief Society with a lifetime experience who are too timid to even navigate the scriptures. Too many of us are comfortable with the mirage of the church as a kind paternal state, and we think all is well in Zion, and thus the devil leads us down to spiritual stagnancy. We must learn to trust our own authority instead of waiting for someone to tell us we're okay. And what if we step on someone else's toes? What if we make a mistake? That's what this probation is for. What if we transgress the rules? Well, the rules change. And Eve transgressed, and because of her good choice, we are here. Eve is the mother of all living. Eve was the first guerrilla girl. Our transgressions of culturally established rules will bring new spiritual life. The work is one-to-one. It's sister to sister, and I'm dead serious about this. It's a slow-burn, life-changing revolution, and it's a life-saving revolution. And it comes in a billion forms, in a billion private personal ways. It comes at dinner time, and in bedtime stories, and on camping trips, and in political activism, and in working at battered women's shelters, and maybe even through visiting teaching, too. It asks no one's permission. It's pure as charity and revolutionary as hell. Our authority is in each other.
Well, we have plenty of time for questions and answers and discussion. Do you want me to start it off with I have a couple of questions I think that are really sort of important for us to talk amongst ourselves. So, discuss. Right. The two questions that I'm most interested in from the discussion is, why cling to terms like masculine and feminine when most everyone has basically said, when I'm talking about masculine with capital M and feminine with a capital F, these terms aren't really gender tied. They have nothing to do really with biological male and biological female. So my question is, why even cling to the term masculine and feminine? Do they have any? Well, I think that's good. And then the other one is to Catherine, after we do that, how do we re-signify our experience? I mean, you've sort of hit on some of that, I think, but how would you, when you talk about staying, you know, within this highly patriarchal structure that the church represents, how do we re-signify our experience? You can give us some examples of that, I think. Is that okay to start out with? Okay, and then we'll go ahead. The first one is on masculinity and femininity. Why cling to those terms?
I think the only reason, too, is because...
You have to come up here.
Oh, dang.
In fact, maybe we should ask, like a choir, you know. I know. Actually,
I'm just
here.
I'm going to let Joanna answer all the questions.
Here.
Yeah, put that down.
There we go. You can pass it back and forth.
I think the only thing, to get theoretical, I mean... The only place we know to go to reclaim what has been lost is to what we call feminine. I mean, we've got to go where woman is because we know she's been put away kind of hardcore for the past century or so, or past millennia, plural. I mean, so if there is a place to go, it's to what is to the traditional feminine, the mystical experience. I mean, that's where we have to return to. But, I mean, eventually, I hope we lose all idea of, you know, masculine, feminine, and just be people. I mean, but we've got to go to feminine first and say, yes, right on women, you know. Yeah.
I think those terms are convenient sometimes. And there is always, always the danger that when you use a term like feminine, that it will be sentimentalized into something that I don't think it is. But when I was writing this paper, I sort of got confused. And I think that it's really easy to do that. You think, okay, did I just have a feminine spiritual experience or a masculine spiritual experience? And I mean, you really can't divide your spiritual experiences into masculine or feminine. If you had a spiritual experience, it was a spiritual experience. It wasn't a feminine spiritual experience or a masculine spiritual experience. So that's what I would say.
I think postmodern ideas, too, about masculine and feminine are that we have to recognize that they are binary opposites. We have to recognize that one is given a connotation of bad and good in order for us to get rid of those structures. And I think a lot of people hadn't really thought of terms in that way. And so I think talking about them in that way first helps us to get rid of those barriers. And hopefully, you know, if we can reaccess this semiotic process of language development, we can come up with new words or we can just construct new meanings and not even be constricted by that. You know, because we're still, no matter how hard we try to talk about what's feminine and what's masculine, we're still talking about what's feminine in a patriarchal language. And so it's very difficult to draw those lines.
Can I be anecdotal? Just briefly?
No.
I have an anecdote.
Yeah, go
it's
ahead.
A good one. 2 weeks ago, I got a little memo in my box about sending mail to Yugoslavia. Have you ever gotten memos in your boxes about sending mail to Yugoslavia? Because there isn't a Yugoslavia anymore, and we have all these new guidelines for sending mail to Yugoslavia. And what you have is 6 republics, and 5 of them go by the names of their republics. In the former Yugoslavia, you have Serbia, Croatia, Bosnia, Montenegro. However, the Republic of Macedonia does not want to be known as the Republic of Macedonia anymore, but it hasn't chosen a name. So the official guideline on a letter is you address it to the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, and that's what they want to be known as. And I think that when we talk about moving beyond, I have a point, moving beyond masculine and feminine, we've got dichotomies here that have been constructed over thousands and probably tens of thousands of years that have separated and segregated human experience that we all have into 2 distinct groups. And even if we try to move beyond, we're still going to have the former masculine and the former feminine that we have to deal with as ways that our experience has been segregated and encoded into our culture in ways that simply aren't going to be gotten rid of overnight. So I'm completely happy with the term the former masculine and the former feminine, but there needs to be a term, at least right now, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to talk about resignification?
For me, and I don't, and I just this year, I guess I'm categorized into the 30 and over feminist. So, so I think a problem that I find when I'm trying to solve problems like this is that leaving the structure for me or leaving the church is not an option that I have chosen. And so it's a very difficult process of deciding how do I stay within this structure but be at peace with myself and be able to feel like I have some integrity as well. And the way that, and it's still an in-process event for me, and I hope that it will be in process forever, because in this spherical feminine model, we always should be changing and resignifying the things that we do. For me, on a day-to-day basis, I have to resignify things like prayer, and I have to resignify those kinds of things with my children. Okay, well, we have a something that's a signifier and something that's been signified. And so if we re-signify something that already is a symbol and has a meaning, then we're giving new meaning to an old symbol. And so I have to go in and I have to re-signify what prayer is to traditional Mormon culture. And I have to change that to have meaning for me. And I do that with my husband in the way that we pray. I do that with my children. And it's really interesting to see it start filtering down, because my son, when he prayed in primary a couple of weeks ago, prayed to his Heavenly Father and his Heavenly Mother. And everybody in that whole room was shocked. I saw everybody's eyes like open up, you know, and nobody said anything. But the thing that made me happy is that he didn't know that, because he had resignified it, because we had been doing that at home. And so you can see it start happening with other generations when you start it that way. And for me, I have to be able to resignify temple experiences. And I have to set them up in metaphors that are meaningful for me. And I have to resignify why I go to church every week and how I can make that a meaningful experience for me and not just going to participate in meetings. And whether that means that I don't go to all the meetings or whether I do, I try and change it so that it has specific meaning for me. In primary, we sing gender-neutral songs. And those are the kinds of ways that I can start putting some of the things that are important to me back into the culture or back into the structure and try to ultimately deconstruct it a little bit at a time, because one person can't do very much. But if all of us are doing it a little bit in all of our own individual communities, we're going to start to see things re-signified and changed in a slow way. But there's enough change for me that it has meaning and that I can find peace in dealing with this day-to-day church or gospel that I live in.
This relates just a follow-up question to that, is when do our symbols, when do we decide that a symbol becomes an inadequate vehicle for, or can't, is so weighed down with baggage that it can't be re-signified? Do you see what I'm saying? Or it's sort of what goes along with it, I suppose, is a why stay in a structure. If you have to so torturously redefine and re-signify, when does that just become counterproductive?
Well, I think I feel really cheeky because I'm obviously younger than the rest of the people here and I haven't lived as long, and so I haven't done all this. But as far as I can see it, just by reading history, I mean, just the perspective that things do change and the hope that this is a dynamic church and realizing that we've got to put up with some of it to get, I mean, you're Mormon already, you know, whether you're inside or outside the church sometimes is metaphysical. I mean, it's still in you, and you're Mormon in every way, in every possible social construction. And either you're living, I mean, you're never free. You can never just get rid of the structure. Either you're directly implicated in it, or you're directly responding to it, saying, I am not a part of it. So you're always trapped by it. So the way you've got to do is you've got to open spaces within it for yourself. Or dance along the minefield, you know, dance, play the borders, you know, and just like Catherine was saying, make your own spaces. Because, I mean, there's no way either in or out. There's a lot that's been done. You know, you're always going to be a Mormon, those symbols will always stand, you know. So, and just with hope and faith in progress and knowing that having a testimony that God is cool and that things will work out. And that is the biggest thing that saved my relationship. That is the thing that saved my relationship with the church, is realizing that God is cool and it will be all I hope it will be. There's a quote by a nun. She says it better than I do. Believing in God means there'll be, knowing that everything will be fair in the end, there'll be many wonderful surprises. You know, just re-signifying in yourself and saying, someday you'll catch up. But meanwhile, I'm going to stay invested in the process because this is my language and this is my people and this is what I know how to do.
Why don't you come up and ask your question up here, because then we don't have to repeat it. Okay. Do we have any deacons to...
I'll be a deacon.
I guess the thing that I'm most amazed at right now is the gentleman here today, and you particularly, because you're speaking. And you said you came from a conservative family. I came from a conservative family, and I see the way my brothers respond as far as patriarchy is concerned and feminism, which is in complete contrast to what we've spoken of today. And so my question is to you, what made the difference and why?
He's really a woman.
Okay. I went to BYU. I came from a very conservative household, and I do want to stress, and I tried to stress in my talk that I think I had a very happy childhood. My mother chose, and it was her choice, a stay-at-home traditional role, and I have absolute respect for the fact that she did that. And I believe that every woman should have that as one choice to make, as well as all of the others. I don't have a problem with that, and maybe I should, but I liked the way that I grew up. I did grow up very conservative. I remember in ninth grade I would come to school dressed in Reagan for President buttons and go handing them out, and I came to BYU, and at first it was simply a reaction. I came to BYU. It was the whole Mondale thing. You'll remember that one, my freshman year. And I just wanted I came to BYU, I just wanted to be the bad boy. I just wanted to be a Democrat because all these stupid Republicans were and so it wasn't even a genuine ideological commitment to any sort of liberal ideology. It was simply I didn't want to deal with all these conservative people who seemed so dumb. And then I went on a mission, and I actually came to California on a Spanish-speaking mission, and I met real people who were real poor people for the first time in my life, and they weren't like I figured they ought to have been. And I experienced some genuine conversions to, not to feminism still, just to the idea that political conservatism wasn't the only way to order your life. And then I came back to BYU and majored in English, and fell under the influence of Cecilia Farr and Gloria Cronin and Susan Howe. And those three women changed my entire perspective on things. I learned so much. I learned to care about them so much. So why am I willing to speak out as a feminist? Is because while I was at BYU, I learned and genuinely loved feminists and really wanted to hear what they said, and that's why. And this is the fourth time I've been the token man on a panel like this. I did this all through BYU.
There are others.
Come on up. Come on up.
I'd just like to point out that "this is because" is faulty predication, Mike.
That's true.
Okay, good. Anyways, I'd just like to ask Joanna, I guess, your vision is very appealing and very fresh and very antinomian. And what I mean by that is, in a way, it privileges the vision of the individual over the weight of tradition and authority. What do you have to say to women who really fear, though? That's my question.
And when you say women who really fear, I suppose you mean women who really fear change and
fear taking a risk of rethinking.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of see, that's what eternity is for, because it's taken a long, long time to get women into this state of damage. Honestly, and it's going to take a long time to get him back. And I told my mom, I'm going to cry. I was sitting at dinner with my mom, and she was having a hard time. And we were talking about meetings, and not going to meetings. And
And I was saying, now you understand. And she and I realized there was something my dad didn't understand. Because as saintly as he is, which he is, he's great. He's as much feminist as I am, really. But there was something he didn't get. And it had taken us 20 years to arrive at that point. And I told her that if it would take another 40 years, we'd go to the next step. And that there were a jillion women out there. And if I personally had to bring every single one of them across, you know, and, like, whatever it took, just being their friend, because that's how it starts out mostly, just being each other's friend, that I would, because I love this. And I know there are other women who feel this way, too, that we love each other. And so it's not... For every person, it's different, you know. It's not like you can say, okay, start reading books, and you'll feel fabulous, you know. I mean, small victories are small, and they take a long time to achieve. But just deep investment in each other. I mean, I really sign on to which one of us was it. It was you or you. Spoke of the interconnectedness of female spirituality. It's just working on our relationships with each other. I don't know how else to explain it. I really believe that conversion happens within. I mean, feminist conversion as well as all the other good kinds of conversion happens within. It's not necessarily something that can be distilled into a program and put into place. If we have this new program at church, we'll all feel feminist and happy by the end of the month. You know, it takes a long time. So, devotion to each other. That's all I can say.
Next contestant. Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to put this up here because I'm going to shake. I really don't have a question as much as a comment I want to make. This is used for reference to a story. This isn't necessarily trying to sell bilingual education, but I think this can relate. I'm a very strong believer in bilingual education, and being a gringa, as they call us in Spanish, being a white person or whatever, a lot of people are surprised and freaked out by it that I'm relating so well with these little, I teach first grade, but these children who are Hispanic. And a couple of weeks ago, one of the bilingual teachers, and I'm the only one in the district who's a gringa and speaks Spanish, said to me, we need to get, you know, we're talking about pay raises and all the stuff that teachers talk about. We need to get some of the gringas together to get people to believe how important this is or whatever, because we're almost like the enemy. There's the Spanish and then there's the American type, and I'm crossing that border. And I think Mike's a good example of that. Instead of looking at, you know, like we've talked about, it's not feminine, you know, female and male. It's the view of the holistic view of our roles. And maybe by including some of these, by relating well to Mike and knowing that there's other people out there. For example, I thought I'd never get married because of my feministic views, but lo and behold, I found a guy who has feministic views. So it does happen, and I think we can, instead of being surprised by them, should almost seek them out and work with them, because they could really be a help to push our beliefs along.
It's not entirely a singular phenomenon. The Boys Club at BYU was about one-third men, wouldn't you say? I'm sorry. The Feminist Activist Club at BYU Voice had about one man for every two women in it, and these were concerned men who had a genuine interest and concern in these issues. And when we had our Take Back the Night rally, there were about 200 women and 100 men there, and that was a start for BYU. But it's men. Lots of men take this seriously. Lots of men, I think, realize that, and then this really is something that I have had to really come to terms with. Being denied access to an entire one half of human experience doesn't do anybody of either gender any good. And I don't think I'm terribly unique in realizing that either.
I want to talk about that fear issue. Just an anecdote. When Mother Wolf the Morning first came out, I saw it and I was very threatened by it. I was a feminist, but I was still very fearful, and especially fearful about tampering with the divine.
okay? And I think fear still comes up in various things, you know? We think, well, okay, I can look at this issue, but not this one and not this one. But I think exactly what these other people are saying, that whether it's bilingual education or something else, when someone presents us with a new view, we may very well be very, very threatened by it. And I thought about that play for about 6 months or a year. And now I'm giving talks about the feminine divine. So, you know, things do change. And, you know, I see this happening just with my sisters. They start out as very conservative Mormon housewives. And, you know, I've been sending them little Sunstone articles and various things for years and years. And then suddenly, you know, one day they'll say, you know, I read that article you sent me. And I say, what article? And it's inevitably something I sent them 3 years ago. But they're at a place in their lives now where they can read it and they're not quite as fearful and they can move into a different place that isn't about fear. So things really do change. I've seen it happen in my own life and in the lives of my family.
Okay, this is going to sound pretty open-ended, and I think I prefer to leave it that way. But whenever we talk about gender, specifically in the church, we use all these terms. We invoke theorists, French theorists. And so we have a spherical sexuality or spirituality. We're fluid, we're semiotic, we're bisexual. I assume that a lot of these things are supposed to be metaphorical and not necessarily that we're supposed to spend a lot of time in the pool. I don't relate to these things on a literal level. And so what I'm wondering is, in the area of pragmatics, you know, day-to-day living, I feel like a lot of our spirituality is enacted through our sexuality and our lives as sexual beings and our relationships with other people. And those certainly need resignification also, and, you know, pretty darn quick. And I guess I just want to ask briefly how you see issues of sexuality affecting your lives and how feminism has affected that part of your lives, and if you really see these things as more literal than symbolic at this point.
I don't know. You're all going to say something, right?
Married people go
first. The jury's still. I mean, the jury's still out. Gloria Cronin talked about how coming of the early 20s, late teens, especially BYU, is a very difficult time for people to become feminists, especially because so much of their life is invested in the prospect of finding a mate, which, you know, so at the time when you most need to stick to all of the rules of good behavior to catch yourself that meal ticket, you know, it's a very difficult time to start taking it all apart. So a lot of it just comes with being very careful with who you date. But I mean, more directly with sexuality, so many of us come with loaded decks on sexuality. So many of us come with experiences that are beyond our control, that are formative. The law of it just comes in healing the self. I mean, I think sexually and spiritually it's parallel, is actually trying to see your coming of age time, like your adolescence or whatever, as a time to piece it back together and to try to figure out who you are before you actually dive into a union with someone else. So in me, feminism gave me that perspective, like you need to worry about you first before you try to take on someone else as well. So
okay, first of all, you're right. All the theory and things is very metaphorical. And for some people that's helpful, and for other people it isn't. And the way that I, you know, talk about that pragmatically is just what we said, is that, you know, if we're spherical, if we're fluid, if we're resignifying our experiences, we're doing exactly what Joanna was saying about, you know, touching other women's lives. that's a spherical model, and that's just a metaphor for us participating with each other in that manner. And if we have fluid relationships versus these linear relationships, then we are reacting to each other and helping each other versus assigning each other things and delegating each other things. And that's the kind of the models that we look for in the gospel that we try to resignify in that way for us. And so theory, in that sense, has been very helpful for me as a metaphor in my life to help just kind of figure out all of these things that have been so much a part of my life, because I grew up in a very conservative home, too, where all of these things were very conditioned responses. And for me to not trust that patriarchal language was a big step, and I needed some tools to help me get to that point. And that's what helped me a lot. And as far as, you know, the sexuality and those kinds of things go, I mean, when I got married, I was not a feminist. And I was married quite young and had children. And my husband became a feminist before I did, about a semester before I did. He went to the University of Utah and started taking all the women's studies courses up there and was coming home with all this terrific literature and sharing it with me, and I was just like, wow. And then that next semester, I took my last course of my senior year from Gloria Cronin on gender in literature, and it was the very first course that had ever addressed that in my college years at BYU. It's the first time I had ever talked about it, and it was a very enlightening, evolving experience. And I'm lucky, I have a lot of friends that have not been this fortunate, but that my husband and I evolved in our feminist ideology together, and it was a very healthy, very enriching, very dynamic experience for both of us.
For their thoughtful remarks, and thank you for your attendance.